This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening for Queer Voices, and tonight on this stormy evening, we have a lot of things in the show tonight, including Maria Gonzalez, who is president of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Political Caucus, talking about the upcoming election. Also, we'll be talking about the Bayou City Boys Club Gospel Lunch, which is happening this weekend. Then, Phyllis Fry and Lily Rodley is going to come in and their new group called Transition will give a preview of what they're going to be doing at the community center. Then Joan is going to be calling in with a segment on ghost hunting. And then Gigi does a pagan origins of Halloween. All that's coming up, but first we go to London and the BBC News.
BBC News with Michael Poles. Syria has again dismissed accusations that it's failed to cooperate fully with the United Nations inquiry into the killing of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The denial came after the UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution threatening unspecified further action against Syria unless it cooperates unconditionally with the investigation. The Syrian Foreign Minister, Farouk Asharar, said the resolution, like the inquiry's interim report, was based on a presumption of Syrian involvement in Mr. Hariri's killing in February, rather than its innocence. The resolution calls on Syria to detain suspects identified by the inquiry. The French Foreign Minister, Philippe Douste-Blazy, spelled out what was expected of the Syrian government.
Les dirigeants syriens doivent comprendre.
Syria's leaders must understand that the Security Council, and through it the entire international community, will not tolerate anything less than immediate and complete cooperation, and that it will draw conclusions from any lapse.
A group of United Nations human rights monitors has said it won't accept an offer by Washington to visit the prison camp for terror suspects at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba, unless it's granted free access to the prisoners themselves. The monitors had originally welcomed the invitation by the U.S. Defense Department, which came after almost 4 years of negotiations between the U.N. and Washington over access to the camp. However, the monitors said that while they could accept a number of limitations imposed by the Pentagon, they could not consent to a ban on private interviews with detainees. The Algerian Leila Zarougi is a special investigator for the United Nations.
The working group on arbitrary detention, we visited more than 20 countries and we never accept to compromise on terms. We always insist on getting a full access to detainees and private interview.
President Bush has nominated a conservative judge, Samuel Alito, for a place on the U.S. Supreme Court, 4 days after his first choice for the post withdrew from the selection process. President Bush described his new candidate as one of the most accomplished judges in the United States, saying he had a deep commitment to justice. Judge Alito is a Roman Catholic who has in the past supported restrictions on abortion. You're listening to the news from the BBC. About 20 people are believed to have been killed after two bombings in the city of Basra in southern Iraq. Local police said a booby-trapped car exploded close to many shops in the commercial district of the city. Another explosion, thought to have been caused by a rocket-propelled grenade, followed soon afterwards, close to the British forces base in the city. David Willis reports from Baghdad.
The explosions occurred near a busy restaurant shortly after the end of the day's Ramadan fast. Police vehicles were among the targets, and two of them are thought to have been destroyed. Eyewitnesses reported a scene of chaos, with dazed survivors stumbling around in the darkness. Basra is the headquarters of British forces in Iraq. Elsewhere, 6 U.S. soldiers have died in two separate incidents, bringing to 91 the number of Americans killed here in the month of October.
The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has demanded that Pakistan should honour its commitment to prevent terrorism directed at India, following the bombings in Delhi on Saturday in which 60 people died. During a telephone conversation with the Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf, the Indian leader spoke of his dismay at indications that the bombers had foreign links. From Delhi, Mike Waldridge reports.
Until news emerged of the telephone call said to have been initiated by the Pakistani leader, the Indian government had been cautious about casting blame for the coordinated triple bombings in any specific direction, though some newspapers and commentators here have been pointing the finger of suspicion at militant groups they claim are backed by elements in Pakistan. The Indian Prime Minister himself, according to the official statement, was still circumspect in talking about signs of foreign links to the Delhi bombers, but toughly worded in his insistence that Pakistan honour a commitment to ending any terrorism directed across the border.
The UN Agency for Children, UNICEF, says it estimates that 17,000 children were among those killed by the South Asian earthquake earlier this month. The agency's executive director, Anne Veneman, warned of a second wave of deaths if children didn't quickly get health care, clean water and immunizations. Some of America's most senior politicians have attended a memorial service in Washington for Rosa Parks, the woman who inspired the civil rights movement in the U.S. The bishop leading the service said the quiet strength of Mrs. Parks had touched the lives of millions. In 1955, Mrs. Parks' refusal to give up her seat on a bus to a white man led to the first peaceful protest against segregation in the American South. Earlier, tens of thousands of mourners filed past Mrs. Parks' coffin at the U.S. Capitol building. BBC News.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Polensky.
And J.D. Doyle.
I'm still Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And we all made it here tonight, despite the weather.
Ooh, it's spooky.
The show must go on, Jack.
It's Halloween, and it's raining, and it's scary, and it's wonderful out for the ghosts and goblins.
And as usual, we're here on a holiday.
And yeah. We're dressed in our costumes, too.
Yes. I love that Dorothy outfit you have on, Glenn.
Our radio costume. Yeah.
No, you misunderstand. Jack and myself and J.D. are dressed as curmudgeons. And you're dressed as a crone?
Yeah, my usual self.
Yes.
That's why we're radio people.
Actually, I went to a great Halloween party at Lazarus House and really fun costumes. I was a gypsy fortune teller. I could either sell you love potion number 9 or read your...
No, that's typecasting.
Yes, I do. Well, hopefully we're going to find out some fortunes with our guest, Maria Gonzalez,
right.
From the...
Before we get to that, let's do a little bit of housekeeping here.
Oh, housekeeping.
Next week, we're going to be raising money here on KPFT. The station is in general, but we are also here at Queer Voices because we're all part of the system here to help fund the station. That allows us to do this type of programming, and we would hope that you all will call and pledge money. Some other national news, big coming out story this week.
Cheryl Swoops with the Houston Comet and the MVP player for nationally announced officially that she is a lesbian, that she was tired of living her life in secret and came out, and also is going to be a spokesperson for Olivia Cruises, which is a lesbian-owned company.
Yeah, now as an activist, you have to read the sports pages, too. Isn't that strange?
And don't forget about George Takei.
Yeah, beam me up, Scotty.
Mr. Sulu from Star Trek.
Yeah, so hopefully it'll be, more people coming out and having the bravery to do that. And then everybody get over it, which is an important thing to take place. But, it's that time of year when people come knocking on your door asking for things.
Yes.
Some of them are trick-or-treaters.
Or trick-and-treaters.
And some of them are...
Voters. Actually,
yes.
We're block walkers looking for voters, asking them the question, who do you support? And vote no, or vote against Proposition 2, the anti-gay, anti-marriage amendment.
I call it the discrimination amendment.
Well, a lot of people have all kinds of names for it these days. I think discrimination is accurate. I'll read it to you real quick. Marriage in this state shall consist only of the union of one man and one woman. The state or political subdivision of this state may not create or recognize any legal status identical or similar to marriage. This just wipes out every kind of relationship anyone has with their partners whatever agreements you've come up with, whatever legal documents you've developed, as well as domestic partnerships.
If you're domestic
common partnerships. Law relationships, and
have they figured out which man and which woman?
Horrible grammar. I mean, the syntax of this sentence is just awful. Being an English professor,
all the better to take it to court later.
I mean, it annuls marriage in the state of Texas. I mean, the way I do this, you know, I was explaining this to my students. I said, begin it this way. This state or a political subdivision of this state may not create or recognize any legal status identical or similar to marriage. Marriage in this state shall consist only of the union of one man and one woman. It just wipes out marriage.
Well, one thing that's redundant about it is that laws in the state of Texas already exist saying that marriage, legal marriage, is only between one man and one woman.
But it's not in the Constitution.
Well, right, but so people, I mean, nothing will change.
No, nothing
by
will
this
change
being passed
in terms
that
of the, you know, the fact that Texas does not allow, because Texas has its own DOMA Defense of Marriage Act law that does not allow gays and lesbians to get married. But what will happen is that now all kinds of relationships are thrown into this unknown realm, because this language is so broad, so vague, so indecipherable, that a judge is going to have to decide what it means. And I'm hoping it's some liberal judge in Austin who decides that there's no such thing as marriage in the state of Texas.
Just annul it for everyone.
Anyway, that's Proposition 2. And that's one of the things that we're doing. We're knocking on doors. That's a the Houston GLBT Political Caucus, in coalition with the Houston Equal Rights Alliance, is working with a no-nonsense campaign statewide to defeat Proposition 2. The other thing that the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is also doing is trying to get our endorsements out. I'm hoping that many of you who are listening received your endorsement cards from us this past week. If not, the Community Center at 3400 Montrose, the Houston Gay and Lesbian the Houston GLBT Community Center at 3400 Montrose, second floor, has these endorsement cards as well. I just left some here at the front door of KPFT. We're trying to get them out.
And they're available online, the endorsements?
And they're available online. Our website is www.hglbtpc.org. It's a new website, hglbtpc.org, because we've become this year inclusive. We used to be just the hglpc.org. We now include our bisexual and transgendered members in our name. So we're now the Houston GLBT Political Caucus, hglbtpc.org.
Before you go into who has been endorsed by the Political Action Committee of the caucus, explain a little bit about the process one goes through in order to receive that endorsement.
The Houston GLBT Political Caucus is recognized as one of the most careful vetters of candidates. The process basically begins, for example, for this November, begins in May, as the board prepares the questionnaires for candidates. In June, we send out letters to all candidates, everyone we can track down, every address we can track down, every candidate who's registered, anybody who might be thinking about being a candidate. I usually just tell people, just get me their name. And what we do is we send them a letter inviting them to screen with us. If we can track down an email, we send them an email to remind them to please let us know if they are interested in screening with us. Usually we get a response, especially from at large positions, mayors, specific districts, and they really want our questionnaires. They want to screen with us. We're very happy to say that we're getting a broader population interested in the caucus endorsement. In June, we send out the questionnaires to anyone who has requested it. We've invited, and we invite broadly. But as you know, there's a lot of candidates who worry about being endorsed by us.
It's kind of ironic because some people actively seek it and honor it and want it, and others are like, oh, no.
Yeah, that's correct.
Talk about scary.
Maybe we should adore some of those people.
Yeah. But, I think one of the important things is that the caucus does not endorse unless the person requests to be endorsed.
That's correct.
Screens with a committee, gets a recommendation.
Fills out the questionnaire. I mean, that's in June they receive the questionnaire. In July we sit down, have a half hour interview with every candidate seeking our endorsement. It's pretty much a grilling half hour because we are looking at their answers. This year's final question, the big question was, do you support the right of same-sex couples to marry? And the simple answer of yes, we got from, of course, the people you expect, like Anise Parker, Sue Lovell. But then we got these elaborate, what I call, answers that are non-answers from many of our supporters because they're being diplomatic and political and careful of the way they respond. We then grill them in a half-hour interview where we really try to pin them down on our issues, the GLBT issues. And at the same time, we're also educating them. One of the important things that has happened this year is we've invited Jennifer Poole to be a member of our board. This past summer, she was one of our screeners. Jennifer Poole is a transgendered individual. She has educated the board and she has educated the candidates on how important it is that transgender, that gender identity be part of the language of non-discrimination. Because the transgendered community is under attack. They're the first fired. They're not hired. Their whole priority is just simple survival. And that, in a half hour grilling of candidates, we push them on such issues. Do they understand what transgendered population faces? Are they willing to address those issues?
I think they also get educated because they often get asked about lots of other questions like, what are you going to do about flooding? What are you going to do about crime? What are you going to do about affordable housing and other issues? Because as citizens of this city, they all affect us.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that we consistently do is we point out that we are citizens of the city. We have the issues. And in many ways, what they discover is that our screeners, the volunteers with the Houston GLBT Political Caucus, are some of the most informed voters in the city. They know the issues. They also know basics, city infrastructure, and they ask about flooding. They ask about, you know, how are we going to get these after-school programs straightened out? How are we going to fund them? They ask about, you know, I mean, last year when we were dealing with county elections, we were talking about health care. We were talking about the hospital county zones and how we were going to pay for that. And just the challenge of them communicating with the city. I mean, the caucus is recognized as the progressive endorsement in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to tell you who we ended up endorsing. I guess I'd
and
like to remind everybody.
And so who might that be?
Well, for mayor, we ended up endorsing Bill White. Surprise, surprise. He actually did very well in our screening. His answers were solid. And one of the things that Bill White did this year, the mayor did, is he only sought two endorsements. He sought our endorsement, and he sought the city union employees' endorsement. He didn't have to seek our endorsement, but clearly he thinks we're important, and I'm really thrilled about that. And, of course, controller. No, none other but Anise Parker. We're going to endorse Anise Parker.
And thankfully, she has no opponent, so...
So she's going to be our controller. We were thrilled about the fact that she doesn't have an opponent.
As she was
the first time ever. I mean, it was just amazing.
Makes it a lot easier to win the election.
Yeah, but it also shows how Anise Parker is recognized for the professional city employee she is. She's one of our top city candidates. I hope someday she will be our mayor. Anise Parker was more than generous with the caucus. She didn't have to donate to the PAC, but she did. She didn't have an opponent, but she wanted to show her support. At large, position one, we endorse Peter Brown, another good friend of our community, top fellow. We really encourage people to go support Peter. At large, position two, of course, Sue Lovell. Like Anise, a past president of the caucus, real important leader in our community.
Someday, Maria Gonzalez
No, I like being a professor of English. Sue Lovell is, as we all know, has always been a leader in our community. We're encouraging everyone to be out there and support her. At large, position 4, Ron Green. An incumbent, he'll do well. He's a real friend of the community. At large, position 5, Mike Stoma. He's facing a real challenge. He's up against the incumbent, Michael Berry. Mike Stoma sought our endorsement, wanted our support. We're doing the best we can to get his name out. In District B, Felicia Galloway Hall. She did a great job in communicating with us, in telling us her interest in working with our community. She did a lot of learning during the screening. She's going to be a really top-notch city council member. In District C, that was a tough race. A whole lot of people sought our endorsement, not just the individual who got it, but Democrats and historical Democrats and historical Republicans sought our endorsement in District C. The winner was Herman Litt by a hair. I do want to say that there are a lot of good candidates in District C. We had to make a decision. Herman Litt was the individual
that's
who got our
endorsement. That's also something that's good, though, is because we're having more candidates to select from that even though we may pick someone and endorse them and want them to be the winner, we don't lose in the long run because we do have so many other wonderful people.
Yeah, in fact, in District C, has such a tight race. Herman Litt got an endorsement. He's top-notch. But I did have to tell many of those other individuals seeking our endorsement in District C that it's important that citizen candidates like them are there, and we told them, we're going to be friends in the future. In District D, Ada Edwards. She's my representative. She's done a top job.
And also without an opponent.
And without an opponent, which is just wonderful. District H, Adrian Garcia. He's always been a friend. He's doing a great job. It's important that we support someone like Adrian. District I, it was Carol Alvarado. She was very supportive. She's mayor pro tem at this point. In District, we also endorsed one individual in the special state rep election to replace the late Joe Moreno's seat. District 143, our candidate is Laura Salinas. She sought our endorsement. She did a good job. She learned a lot in our screening, but she's also someone who understands many of our issues. We endorsed one individual in the HISD School Board of Education candidate. That's for District 1, and our candidate there is Richard Guntu. He's a top fellow. District 1, Richard Guntu, knows a great deal about our community. I was, in fact, very impressed with the fact that he already understood not just our LGBT issues, but our transgendered issues. It's so rare when you come across a candidate who understands issues about the transgender.
And important for someone to understand about safe schools.
That's right. And that's one of the important things. Richard Guntu promised that we're going to really challenge safe school issues. We're going to get our students protected, all our students protected, whether they're straight, gay, or transgendered or bisexual. And finally, of course, we're asking everyone to vote against Prop 2, the anti-gay, anti-marriage, discriminatory amendment. And I know you'll all get out and vote. It's early vote time, 7 to 7. You can vote at the multipurpose center over there on West Gray and Wall.
And early voting ends on Friday.
And the election is next Tuesday, November 8th. Don't forget to vote.
Maria Gonzalez, the president of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgendered Political Caucus. Thank you for being on Queer Voices.
And that website is hglbtpc.org. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The EU warns Poland's president to closet his homophobia, the law-changing end of the Wild Blood Affair, and delicious duets, songs steadfastly folk, and electronic dance pop from the audiophile. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 29, 2005. Polish gays and lesbians must be on edge following the election in mid-October of homophobic Warsaw Mayor Lech Kaczynski as the country's new president. In June, Kaczynski defiantly refused to grant the permit for a pride parade in his city. More than 2,500 people marched anyway and were pelted with eggs and stones by angry onlookers. Then, last month, Kaczynski's ultra-conservative Law and Justice Party won control of the nation's parliament. Kazimierz Marcinkiewicz, nominated by the Law and Justice Party to lead the next government as prime minister, has also made his homophobia crystal clear. In the Polish edition of Newsweek magazine, Marcinkiewicz called homosexuality unnatural, saying if such a person tries to infect others with their homosexuality, then the state has to intervene in such an abuse of freedom. The European Union this week issued an explicit warning to Poland's new president about protecting the rights of gays and lesbians. In a sternly worded letter, the European Commission expressed concern about Kaczynski's well-known record of homophobia and said Poland must comply with the Union's lesbi-gay inclusive anti-discrimination regulations. The letter reminded Kaczynski that all member states must abide by those edicts and warned that the EU would invoke the Treaty of Nice, which strips member states of their voting rights if Poland violates the European Union's constitution.
Two men appeared at a South London magistrate's court this week in connection with the death of 24-year-old Jody Dabrowski, who was brutally attacked in the early morning hours of October 15th. Dabrowski suffered a violent, disfiguring attack in Clapham Common that left him unconscious. He was found by a passerby and died about 2 hours later in a local hospital. Law enforcement officials mounted a very visible campaign to catch Dabrowski's killers and acknowledged early on that the attack was motivated by homophobia and would be treated as a hate crime. The two men in custody were identified by authorities as 25-year-old Thomas Pickford and 33-year-old Scott Walker, both of whom are homeless. Scotland Yard said the two men were arrested a week after the killing. They spoke in court only to confirm their identities. Their lawyers made no application for bail, so they will remain in custody. Walker and Pickford are scheduled to appear at the Old Bailey Court at the end of January to face charges.
In more queer-positive European news, Sweden's civil partnerships will soon be eligible to be solemnized in the nation's largest Protestant denomination. The Church Assembly of the Swedish Lutheran Church decided this week to develop a system to offer special blessing ceremonies to same-gender couples who have signed a legal partnership agreement. 160 members of the church's governing body voted in favor of the proposal, with 81 voting against and 8 abstentions. The blessing ceremonies are expected to be instituted by 2006. Individual ministers won't be forced to officiate, but every congregation will be held responsible for recruiting willing clergy, if necessary, to make the ceremonies available. The Swedish government has also moved to expand the availability of partnership ceremonies. Under planned revisions to the civil partnership law, civil registrars who refuse to perform same-gender ceremonies would lose their licenses. Swedish civil partners have virtually the same rights and responsibilities as married couples, so much so that a government committee is considering whether to eliminate the distinction and make the current marriage law gender neutral.
Meanwhile, an overwhelming number of participants at the annual meeting of the Episcopal Diocese of Connecticut would like to follow the Swedish Lutherans' lead. A resolution was passed there urging that priests be allowed to preside at the state's new same-gender civil unions. Bishop Andrew Smith called the motion's passage a sense of this convention at this time, but cautioned that it did not give priests the authority to perform the unions. Smith said the matter would be discussed further and that nothing could actually change until the House of Bishops meeting in 2006.
Alaska's Supreme Court ruled unanimously this week that refusing to grant domestic partner benefits to gay and lesbian public workers violates the state constitution's Equal Protection Clause. The case began in 1999, soon after Alaska voters became one of the nation's first to approve a state constitutional amendment banning legal recognition of same-gender marriages. Represented by the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, 9 lesbian or gay state and municipal employees, or retirees, filed a lawsuit against the state and the municipality of Anchorage, seeking the domestic partner benefits state policy denies them. The lawsuit noted that their partners were prevented from sharing the health, pension, and insurance benefits which heterosexual couples receive. The state had argued that denying gay and lesbian employees domestic partner benefits furthered its interest in promoting marriage. A lower court ruled that the state and city did not have to extend benefits, reasoning that unmarried heterosexual couples are also not eligible. But this week's state high court ruling rejected that logic, noting that heterosexual couples can choose to get married, while same-gender couples cannot, and that denying benefits to these same-sex domestic partners who are absolutely ineligible to become spouses has no demonstrated relationship to the interest of promoting marriage. Anchorage city officials said they would not appeal the ruling, but Alaska's Republican Governor Frank Murkowski is outraged by it, according to his spokesperson Betty Hultberg. She told reporters that Murkowski has ordered the state attorney general's office to find ways to overturn it.
The withdrawal of Harriet Meyer's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court appears to be another serious blow to an already reeling Bush administration. Some critics say it's proof positive of the White House's overdependence on the extreme religious right. As conservative Republican opposition to the judicially inexperienced Myers grew, the news that the president's top aides had tried to assure Christian conservatives that their boss's longtime attorney would overturn reproductive freedoms and block GOBT civil rights only eroded support for the confirmation campaign even more. With Myers out of contention, the presumed shortlist of replacements for the moderate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor includes several judges with conservative anti-gay and lesbian track records, such as Janice Rogers Brown and Priscilla Owen, each of whom won federal bench appointments after bitter Senate battles. Meanwhile, Justice O'Connor continues to participate in Supreme Court deliberations on pivotal cases involving key constitutional issues. The Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on lesbian and gay service members is the subject of a case to be argued on December 6th.
And finally, there were not one but two highly visible coming out stories in the U.S. this week. Women's basketball star Cheryl Swoops of the Houston Comets told ESPN magazine that she is a lesbian, making her the first African-American basketball player to come out. Swoops is one of the most popular and fiercest competitors in the Women's National Basketball Association. She's won three Olympic gold medals and is a five-time WNBA All-Star. Swoops leads the league in most valuable player titles. She's been the leading vote getter in All-Star Game balloting 5 of the 6 years it's been held, and was crowned this year's All-Star MVP. She's played for the Comets since 1997 and was one of the first players signed by the WNBA when the league was formed in 1996. In the ESPN magazine article and subsequent interviews, Swoops also acknowledged her partner, former Comets assistant coach Elisa Scott, who resigned her post in January, reportedly due to the conflict of interest presented by her relationship with Swoops. Their 7 years together has apparently been an open secret in the WNBA. With Scott, Swoops is raising her 8-year-old son from an earlier marriage. I was at a point in my life where I'm just tired of having to pretend to be somebody I am not, Swoops told the New York Times. I was basically living a lie for the last 7-8 years. I was waiting to exhale.
Also this week, George Takei, best known for his role as Mr. Sulu in the much-loved Star Trek TV series and movies, came out in an article in the Los Angeles Queer News Weekly Frontiers, adding that he's been with his partner for nearly 2 decades. The Japanese-American Takei lived in a World War II U.S. internment camp as a child. He said he grew up feeling shameful about his ethnicity and his sexuality. He likened prejudice against lesbians and gay men to racial segregation. Takei said, "The world has changed from when I was a young teen feeling ashamed for being gay. The issue of gay marriage is now a political issue. That would have been unthinkable when I was young." The now 68-year-old actor has been with his partner Brad Altman for 18 years. Takei joined the Star Trek cast in 1973 as Mr. Sulu, a character he played for 3 seasons on television and in 6 subsequent films, and he also ran for the Los Angeles City Council in 1973. He continues to act with the East West Players, a Los Angeles theater group of which he is the president. George Takei, still going where no senior Asian American gay stage TV science fiction actor has gone before.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 29th, 2005, written this week by John Beaupre, Lucia Chappell, and Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm John Beaupre.
This is Queer Voices.
We had a segment a while back with one of the representatives from the Bayou City Boys Club, and he's back. Brian Levinka, the secretary of that organization, is back to give us some information about an event they have coming up. He's also co-chair of that event. Brian, welcome to Queer Voices.
Nice to be here.
What is this event?
This is the gospel brunch that we originally had scheduled for October 2nd, but unfortunately the hurricane kind of changed plans for that. It's now scheduled for this Sunday, November 6th, from 11:30 to 2:30. And it will be held at the Rice Lofts Crystal Ballroom, which, if you haven't been to the Crystal Ballroom, it's a magnificent facility.
Have you done an event like this before?
This is actually our third time to do this. We've traditionally done this in the spring. But we have another event that we do in the spring, the Jungle Party, and that's also a large fundraiser. So we decided to move this to the fall to kind of not conflict with that event.
Spread it out a little bit.
Yeah, kind of not ask the community for all the money at one time.
Oh, this is a fundraiser.
Yes, sir. It's a fundraiser for the People with AIDS Coalition of Houston, a very worthy organization. We are a nonprofit fundraising organization, and we hold these social events to raise money for various organizations in the community, primarily HIV/AIDS organizations.
So how do you pick which organization to get the money?
Well, we ask for proposals from the organizations, and we kind of try to spread the money out through different organizations from time to time. You know?
So they have to apply.
They pretty much apply, yes.
Kind of like screening for the caucus, almost.
Exactly.
And this is the first time you've done it at this site?
Yes. We did it at the Warwick Hotel in the spring, but...
Oh, that's pretty snazzy.
It was snazzy, but it got bought. It was bought out, so it was not available again. So we decided to kind of move it downtown and kind of make it a little bit more fun. The Rice Ballroom, the Crystal Ballroom, has a balcony. It's on the second floor, and it's kind of reminiscent of like a New Orleans type feel. And I think if the weather holds out this weekend, it'll be quite a festive, fun time for everyone.
And who's leading this? You know, do you have a director leading the singing, or do you have guest singers coming already?
We have two soloists now, and we're working on a choir. The choir, we're almost had that nailed down, but. Our first soloist is Toby Linville. He's with the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston. He's a wonderful soloist. And our second soloist is Diona Greenleaf, who is traditionally our closer for the gospel brunch. She closes the show and brings the house down every time. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Let me kind of mention what else you're going to get. We always have Bottomless Mimosas, which is a huge hit with everyone that goes. We have a catered brunch buffet, and this time it's going to be catered by Sambuca in the Rice Hotel, or Rice Lofts, and of course jazz music. And this is a fundraiser, so all the proceeds that we raise, 100% will go to the People with AIDS Coalition of Houston.
Do you get good participation from the audience with this? Or?
Well, we're hoping that we will this time. The last time was a little bit subdued. It was more of a kind of a concert feel. This time we're going to maybe have a little bit more lively music and a little bit more spontaneous, not so much of a program.
How do you think you're going to get participation?
Well, we're just going to go around and make people participate. Maybe we'll put some tambourines around and, you know, channel the Holy Spirit and get crazy.
So do you have to stay here for the entire event, or you can just come at any time between 11:30 and 2:30?
You can come. The music will be kind of spontaneous, starting at noon and going till about 2. Of course, we're serving food, so you know, you come and have your brunch and have some mimosas and hang out on the patio and be social. I'd also like to mention that we're having a silent auction, too, for the first time. And we're still working on some of the items, but we already have a tux package from Alice Formal Wear. We have some luggage from the Hartman Galleries, and we have some antiques from the Retropolitan Ballroom. And we are working on possible plane tickets that may materialize this week. So it'll be a pretty nice silent auction, I think, and hopefully it'll raise some money for the People with AIDS Coalition.
So now you said that all the money that is raised at all the admission money goes directly to the charities. Mm-hmm. So that means that you all must raise the money to put the event on.
Yes, we do. We have underwriters and corporate sponsors, and our goal is to pay for as much of the party before the party starts, so that the money from the tickets will go to the beneficiary.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Bayou City Boys Club. What is the organization made up of?
Okay. It's an organization that was founded 13 years ago as a result of a jungle party, a party that was held for a group of guys having their 30th birthday, and they decided to make it a fundraiser. It was so successful that they've had a jungle party every year since, and now we're on our 14th version of that. The Bayou City Boys Club is kind of the organization that puts on these parties. We do 4 major events a year. Jungle, of course, gospel brunch. We had the summer theater night in the summer. And then we also have our Christmas party, the Red Ribbon Toy Drive, in December. So we have periodic fundraising events throughout the year.
Who can join this organization?
Anyone. I mean, we're looking for hardworking individuals that are willing to give back to the community. It's a volunteer organization. There's no pay. It's just, you know, volunteers. And we're looking for people that are willing to work and to give back.
Any age.
Any age.
Not boys.
Well,
not limited to boys.
Most of the members are far from boys, I would say. Pretty much, 30, 40, some 20s. 20-year-olds.
And about how much money was raised last year by the organization?
We raised $57,000 at our last jungle. It was the most successful jungle to date. The last gospel brunch raised about $3,800. My personal goal, and I kind of am hesitant to say this, is $5,000. But, you know, it's going to take support from people listening right now and from people coming and attending our event. But I'm confident and optimistic.
Well, that's great. How many people would you like to see at the event?
We had 320 at the last one in the spring. I would personally like to see 350 to 400. That's my goal.
And how could you get some more information about the gospel brunch?
That's a wonderful segue. There's information on our website at www.bcbc.info. That's where all of the gospel brunch information is. You can also purchase tickets there currently. You can also purchase tickets at Milliware at 415 Westheimer or from any BCBC member.
Okay, so that's let's go over this again. It's this Sunday.
Yes, sir.
At between 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And people can show up at the door.
Yes, tickets at the door will be $60. Let's talk about that. Advanced tickets are $50, available right now on the website or at Milliware. At the door, there will be $60, but you're welcome to show up at the door.
Okay, and that's at the Rice Lofts Crystal Ballroom, which is 909 Texas Avenue, downtown.
Yes, it's pretty much at Texas and Main, if you know the Rice Building, right there by the light rail.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you for coming by.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
And we've got some gospel music to go out with us to the Transcendence Gospel Choir. That was the Transcendence Gospel Choir from their album Whoever Believes, singing Safe in the Arms of Jesus. And as a footnote, that is the first all-transgendered choir, chorus in the country, and the album is an award-winning album. They got the best choral album at the last year's Hot Music Awards.
This is Queer Voices.
I wanted to get up and shout. It was not I who made love into a dirty word, it is you.
And now the dramatic conclusion of Peter Wildblood and the Montague Affair, the scandal that led to the abolition of Britain's anti-gay sex laws in the mid-20th century. This Way Out's Lucia Chappelle recaps the story as we heard it in part one.
On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me three girl guides, two boy scouts, and my Lord Montague of Bewley.
We've come to arrest you, Wildblood, for offences arising out of your association with Edward McNally and John Reynolds in the summer of 1952.
Peter Wildblood and the Montague Affair is the story of the people and events that led to the repeal of laws against gay sex in Britain. In this dramatization, we've learned about aristocrat Peter Wildblood's work in the early 1950s as a London journalist and his coming out amidst the Cold War mentality of the time when homosexuals were targeted as perverts and security risks. In the summer of 1952, Wildblood went on holiday with his lover, RAF Corporal Edward McNally, to the beach home of his friend and fellow journalist, Edward Lord Montague of Bewley. There they were joined by Montague's cousin, Michael Pitt Rivers, and McNally's RAF friend, John Reynolds. A few months later, two Boy Scouts charged Montague with having molested them at the beach house, and Wildblood ended his troubled relationship with McNally. McNally eventually surrendered love letters from Wildblood to the authorities. All of these events set in motion the prosecution of Montague, Pitt Rivers, and Wildblood on charges of having committed indecent acts.
These two airmen are men of the lowest possible moral character. They were willing parties to these unnatural offences, although, of course, they were committed under the seductive influence of lavish hospitality from these men who were so infinitely their social superiors.
What made it even worse was the knowledge that these letters were not only being used as evidence against myself, but against Edward and Michael.
On a March day in 1954, Peter Wildblood stood in the dock of an English courtroom and said, in the terminology of the day, I am an invert.
Hugh Young continues his account of the trial and the events that followed in the conclusion of this special series.
Wildblood spent 5 hours in the witness box, pointing out that his letters to McNally, though passionate, did not contain a single obscene phrase or one suggestive of sexual relations. The prosecution case relied on innuendo and the proposition that there was no smoke without fire. Lord Montague was next. Prosecutor Khaki Roberts asked why Eamon Reynolds should make up such wicked inventions against him.
Well, I think the best answer would perhaps be something I heard Reynolds say before the magistrates at Lymington, that he was so terrified that he was prepared to answer yes to anything that was put to him, that he had given up hope, and that he did not know how much to say in order to please them.
The court adjourned for the weekend, and Wildblood learnt that his house in London had been burgled. Nothing of value had been taken, but the intruder had been through his papers, flinging them about as though looking for something. In his closing address, Peter Rawlinson unravelled the lies McNally had told and why he had told them, contrasting this with Wildblood's frankness, and arguing as best he could that a man could write a passionate love letter to another man without them having had sex. Lord Montague's barrister, Mr. Fernley Whittingstall, emphasised the need for equality before the law and poured scorn on the lavish hospitality.
Lavish hospitality? It looks fine, does it not, when you get a peer and a successful journalist to talk about lavish hospitality. But from the point of view of Lord Montague, a loaf of bread and some champagne cider. From the point of view of Wildblood, eggs for an omelette and a few slices of salami. Lavish hospitality.
The night before the summing up, journalists were laying odds of 11 to 2 that the three would get off. The judge's summing up was not favourable. He failed to mention that Wildblood had been kept from seeing his solicitor for 5 hours after his arrest. When he summarised the defence case, he mentioned the Crown's allegations, and he was obviously horrified by Wildblood's admission that he was an invert. The jury was out for 4.5 hours. It returned verdicts of guilty in all but one case, in other words, that the principal witness for the Crown had lied, but it didn't matter. Wildblood and Pitt Rivers got 18 months. Lord Montagu of Beaulieu, whose crimes were deemed less serious, got a year in prison. Outside the court, there was an impromptu demonstration. Not against the three convicted men, as it had happened 59 years earlier to Oscar Wilde, but against the two witnesses, McNally and Reynolds. White and weeping, they were bundled into a police car where they lay on the floor under raincoats while a crowd yelled, hissed and beat on the windows of the car with umbrellas and rolled up newspapers. Some hours later, Wildblood, Montagu and Pitt Rivers were escorted into a stately Rolls-Royce for their trip to prison, and the crowd around them called out, "Keep smiling," clapped and gave them thumbs-up signs. The House of Commons briefly debated homosexuality, followed by the House of Lords, and a distinguished mathematician killed himself in relative obscurity in Manchester. Alan Turing, whose work at Bletchley Park on the Enigma Code had helped to win the war, and whose fundamental work on the nature of numbers and codes had paved the way for the digital computer, had been convicted of homosexual acts in 1952 and spent a year on female hormones by his own choice. Perhaps he would have been happier in prison. Perhaps he would have lived. Wildblood found that homosexuality was quite well accepted there, and many gay men were inside for something else. He saw, for the first time in his life, men openly in love with each other. Outside, Monty became for a time a slang term for homosexual, and the words of our theme song were written, happily confusing homosexuality, prostitution, transvestitism, and paedophilia. After all the to-do about social inferiors, Lord Montagu was accepted as one of the boys when he was seen to pick up a potato with his fingers from the bench where it had fallen and put it on his plate. Then they were separated and sent to three different prisons, Wildblood to Wormwood Scrubs, as unpleasant as its name. On the same day, July the 8th, 1954, it was announced that Home Secretary David Maxwell Fyfe had finally given in to the demands of Sir Robert Boothby and the Church of England and agreed to set up an official inquiry into homosexuality. While he was inside, Wildblood began writing his book, Against the Law, an influential indictment of the prison system as well as the law against homosexual acts. After he was released, he gave evidence, and he was one of the few gay men with nothing to hide who could speak freely to retired headmaster J.F. Wolfenden and his committee. The Wolfenden Report, recommending decriminalisation of homosexual acts, was presented in 1957. It was 10 more years before it became a defence to a charge of indecency that both men were consenting, aged 21 or more, and in private. That is, there were no more than two of them.
On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 12 strapping strumpets, 11 lecherous lesbians, 10 tempting trollops, 9 naughty Nancys, 8 obliging aunties, 7 salacious sextants, 6 convicted vicars, 5 queer choirs.
This program was prepared and presented by Hugh Young. The part of Peter Wildblood was played by John Jolliffe, other parts by Chris Parkin and John Boyd.
Four virgin maids, three girl guides, two boy scouts, and my Lord Montagu of Beaulieu.
This Way Out listener, Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Dayton, Ohio, in honor of his mother, Mabel Simmons, has issued a donor matching challenge to supporters of this program. To continue doubling our pleasure, Dr. Simmons has extended the deadline to November 30th, 2005. Please visit our website, thiswayout.org, for holiday gift-giving ideas, a year-end tax break, and to see how your help to keep This Way Out on the air will still mean twice as much to us. We'd be very thankful.
One of Canada's finest musicians and vocalists, Lucy Blue Tremblay, is a well-known and popular singer-songwriter from Montreal, Quebec. She plays the guitar and classical piano with finesse, composing her own songs in English or French. And she's going to be in Houston Saturday, November 5th at 6 p.m. for an evening of unforgettable unforgettable music and a great cause. Lucy Blue Tremblay in concert and a fundraiser for the Breast Exam Project. Come early to see the incredible, fully customized Breast Exam Project Chopper. This is a fully rigged motorcycle. And that is at Resurrection MCC Church, 2025 West 11th Street in Houston. For more information, call Arden at 713-869-1482 or email aeca87@houston.rr.com. Lucy Blue Tremblay in concert this Saturday night. And now, here's some of Lucy's music.
FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
I guess a little bit of Trick or Treat up to the top of the hour. We didn't play Lucy Blue Tremblay as we were thinking we were going to. We play instead a song called Trick or Treat by Corinne Curcio. We'll catch up with Lucy Blue a little later in the show, but right now we got much more music. We've got special guests live in the studio, and we don't do this very often, so this is a treat. We've got Phyllis Fry and Lily Roddy, and they have a singing group called Transition. And they're going to sing a couple songs and talk about the show they have coming up. Who wants to talk about the reason for the show?
Well, the reason for the show is a fundraiser for the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center. And this is going to be Lily's and my first concert.
Our first concert.
As a transition. We've done open mics around town, but we've never done a full two-hour concert. And so we wanted to do that and make it a fundraiser for our community's community center.
How long have you been performing together?
About 2.5 or 3 years so far.
Oh, wow, great.
Yeah, Lily has been playing since she was, well, a long time.
I only had 3 strings on the guitar when I started.
I've always been a singer, but I've never been able to accompany myself. And during my life, I've picked up and unfortunately put down the guitar about 6 times. But when I turned 50, which was 7 years ago, I stayed with it. And so I've been playing for about 7 years. And Lily and I hooked up about 2.5, 3 years ago. And this will be our first concert.
Is there a story behind the two of you getting together? Well, I met Phyllis at a it's sort of a gathering with Diane Garcia several years ago. And then later on when I did my name and gender change, I went to Phyllis, and she did a wonderful job. And then we started talking about playing the guitar, and then it followed. We started playing just for fun, and then she had such a good work ethic, I can hardly not play with her.
Well,
musically, yes.
I appreciate that, but I tell you what, she has really made me learn a lot of chords that I not only was not planning to learn, I didn't even know were in existence, which are in some of the other songs, not the ones we're going to do tonight. But we've got 16 songs, 8 songs for each set and a break in between. But you know, she just has taught me so much about playing guitar. I also go to a weekly guitar circle on Tuesday night. Hey, gang, listening. I picked that up through Leisure Learning, LLU.com, and I invite anyone who wants to play guitar and sing, if they want to join our weekly guitar circle, to go through Leisure Learning.
Phyllis, you're not normally known as a singer. What else might we know you for in this community?
Well, my law firm's website is nsflaw.us. That's Netchman, Seminole, Fry, law.us. I am pretty much the grandmother of the national transgender legal and political movement. And I think it is a testament to the fact that Jennifer and Lily and Kristen and so many other transgender activists here in Houston and in the state and the United States, both male to female and female to male, have really come out and gotten active so that I don't have to be, you know, beaten down the door so much anymore, and I have time to play my guitar and sing and enjoy a little bit of life now.
And Lily Roddy, where else might we know you for in the community?
Oh, well, I write a monthly column for Outsmart magazine and the astrology column, and I've been involved in that in astrology for a long time, like 23 years. And so that's primarily what I do. But I also try to be as active as I can in the trans community. I've served in different officer positions in the different organizations. And so I just try to give back to the community the things that were given to me.
And there are quite a few TG organizations in this community. We're pretty lucky in this area.
We're very lucky, and we're very lucky to have groups that specialize in different parts of the transgender community, because instead of having to be sort of all lumped together, so that sometimes we can come lumped together, like during the Unity Banquet, and then other times in our individual meetings, so that we can actually sort of discuss specific issues to each group, you know, different from one group to the next.
Well, it gives the groups a chance to focus on their own interests that way.
Absolutely.
But I must say that things are expanding because every November we've had, for the last 6 years, the Transgender National Day of Remembrance. But this year in Houston, the Transgender Unity Committee is getting together with other organizations, and even though it's still going to be the Transgender Unity Committee Day of Remembrance, it's actually going to be a day of remembrance of those people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, who express gender differently and who have been murdered for that expression. So it's going to be a full community thing. That's going to be Sunday, November the 20th, I believe it is. So around 7:30-ish. I'm not sure.
The doors open at 6:30.
It's going to be at the Houston Holocaust Museum.
Oh, that's a wonderful space.
Yeah, yeah.
The name of your duo is Transition. Who thought of the name?
Well, we came up with a lot of different things.
Oh, what did you reject?
You know, there's things you don't say over there. And I pardon for clearing my voice. I picked up a frog when I was in New England last week, and I hope I can get through the songs that we're going to sing tonight. I know we'll be fine by Friday because I am getting my voice back. But, you know, I don't, even though I would sound like a feminine frog, I don't want to sound like a frog. So we'll see how it goes tonight with the songs. But we wanted a name. You know, Lily is out. I'm out. We wanted to make sure our group's name was out. And so we played with a lot of different trans terms and finally came up with Transition.
And ready to have you do a song. I understand you're not going to do Judy Collins Both Sides Now.
Well, you know, Deborah, when she found out we were doing a Judy Collins song, and let me say this about our concert. Lily and I have worked hard, even though we're doing covers. There's a lot of good covers out there, and we've worked hard to make sure that we only do one cover per artist, because we want to do a full range. We've got a little bit of rhythm and blues, and we've got some love ballads, and we've got some really smoking rock all mixed in there by different artists. And I've forgotten where I was going to go with this. Oh, yeah, Judy Collins. And I mentioned some of the artists that we were going to perform. And when I mentioned Judy Collins, she says, oh, you're going to do Both Sides Now. It'd be so appropriate being transgendered.
And it's my favorite song in the whole world.
I assume y'all heard that. Anyway.
Angleton heard it.
Yes. You know, I had never even considered it. Had you considered it?
No, I played it many years ago, 20 or 30 years ago. So,
and it's a great song, and it's an appropriate song, but we're going to do Someday Soon. Sorry.
Okay. Well, let's hear some now.
Which one are you going to start out with?
Well, this song has a history. It was written by Willie Nelson, and he wrote it when Patsy Cline was just coming out and recording. And he wrote it specifically for her. That's the legend, anyways. And she didn't like it. She didn't like it at all. She didn't want to do it. But some friends of her prevailed on her to record it, and it's become one of her real signature songs. It's called Crazy. When we started doing it, I was trying to sing like Patsy Cline, and I learned that this song works better for me if I don't sing like Patsy Cline, because I can't sing like Patsy Cline. And then I started working the harp into it, and then Lily started working her lead guitar, and now we're at a point to where from the very first strum of the song, she takes off with some lead guitar work that is just fantastic. And so we've got a microphone right in front of her guitar.
You're just too kind, Phyllis.
So that my big 12-string doesn't drown her out. And we begged the engineer to make sure and pick up her lead guitar work because it is so fine.
Let's see what it sounds like.
The song is called Crazy. And we have learned, haven't we, that it works best if we go slow.
Really slow.
1, 2, 3... Four.
Well, you were good.
Our engineer tells us we have time for one more song if we get right to it.
All right.
So you want to show us some variety that we can sample at your concert?
Yeah, we're going to do a little blues song. You want to intro it, Lily?
No, we're going to do Bourgeois Blues by Hedy Ledbetter. It's sort of my blues background from Beaumont, Texas, where I grew up when I was younger. And
Well, some of us came from there, too.
That's right. Some of us are still trying to get away from there.
Yeah.
And Bourgeois Blues is a song that was actually got Hedy Ledbetter out of prison. And so it's about Washington, D.C., and tonight we're going to sort of rewrite some of the words for our current community and some of the shenanigans that go on in Washington, D.C.
Are we ready?
I guess so. Washington, they know how. Throw a tranny girl nickel just to see her bow. Lord, it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm gonna spread the news all around. Thank you, fellas. Listen to me. Don't live in stealth or we'll never be free. Lord, it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm gonna spread the news all around. I don't visit the street by no bourgeoisie. Lord, it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm gonna spread the news all around. I got the bourgeois blues. I'm gonna spread that news all around.
Bourgeois Blues by Transition. I was talking to Phyllis yesterday on the phone about their appearance tonight, and she encouraged me to plug my next Queer Music Heritage show because it's going to feature a friend of hers. I interviewed this past week Jessica Xavier and Georgie Jessup and Veronica Klaus because I'm doing an all transgendered artist show on my next edition of Queer Music Heritage. That's the fourth Monday of November, and a week after that, I'm doing a bonus show with all transgendered artist music. No interviews, but cram me as much music as I can get in. So it'll be 2 weeks in a row, all TG music. But let's talk about the fundraiser again. We got to go through the who, what, when, where, why.
This Friday night, the GLBT Community Center, which is 3400 Montrose. Okay, that's the building across from Starbucks and across Hawthorne from Disco Kroger's. It's on Hawthorne and Montrose. It's got parking in the back. covered parking in the back. There's going to be somebody there from the nightclub who's going to want $5 from you. Tell them you're with us. Maybe they'll let you in for free. Maybe they won't. But it's going to be at 8 o'clock. We are on the second floor, floor number 2, 3400 Montrose.
207 is the room number.
What did I say? I didn't.
This is the second.
Anyway, every single dime is going to the community center. All of the refreshments are all being donated. Our time's being donated. Everything's being donated. Not one penny is going to reimburse anybody. It's all going to the community center.
We want to thank Phyllis Fry and Lily Roddy for giving us a live performance and a preview of their concert. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
From the audio file this month, the Upstairs Choir is in good company here and in the cosmos.
Here's to you. Sweet harmony, rising from a stoop to ride the wind, just a bridge away from Babylon. In a dark railway station serenade, silent people as they travel on.
In Good Company is the title and very apt description of a new release by cabaret artist Layla Sack. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. He gets some help from some very talented artists from the cabaret and musical theater world, and the result is 17 exquisite duets.
I recorded this album to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of my record label, LML Music, and I wanted to do something a little special, a little different, and so we decided, my co-producer and I, to create an all-duets recording, and so this was a new venture, and I'm really, really thrilled with it, really proud of it, and I hope you like it.
Find out more about the album In Good Company by Layla Sack at www.lmlmusic.com.
From Rochester, New York, Ben Schaefer brings us his debut album called The Upstairs Choir.
Good friend came to visit me north of Amsterdam, brought with him a little toy train, thought nothing of that, took me by the hand, thought I needed a man with a strong stance, didn't know I've swallowed many soldiers whole.
I would consider my music folk music, possibly folk pop. I mean, it might have some borderline pop or indie or alternative aspects, but I'm sticking to my guns as far as labeling it as folk music.
We think it goes beyond folk music with a variety of instrumentation that he wraps around very intriguing lyrics.
It started off in the park. Aggressive men in the bars, now he's got them on both ends of the line. Of the line. Dancing on a Saturday night, he's got his prey inside. Him in, puts his hands down the pants of a man he just met. How about that?
can learn more about the album The Upstairs Choir by Ben Schaefer at www.benschaefer.com. That's www.benschaefer.com.
Cosmos is the name of the debut album by Cremo, and it starts with a song about world peace and tolerance.
Cosmos, and it's electronic pop and has influences of rock, punk, glam, and R&B. It's music you can dance to, sing along with, and even drive in your car. It's some really good driving songs. Upbeat lyrics, some of it will make you laugh, some of it will inspire you to think. Most of all, just have fun. It's just fun music.
Find out more about the album Cosmos by Cremo at www.cremo.com. That's www.cremo.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Lucia Chappell, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Hugh Young, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by grants from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the Lesbian Equity Foundation of the Jewish Community Endowment Fund, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. We thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to find out how your help to keep this program on the air will still mean twice as much to us. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, simply email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CKLU, Sudbury, Ontario, Radio Free Santa Cruz, California, WSUI, Iowa City, Iowa, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. And because it was a dark and stormy night, and particularly because of lightning, our transmitter is operating at reduced power this evening. So if you're having a little bit of trouble picking up the signal, that's why. Hopefully we're going to be able to get to solving that problem in the next hour. You're listening to Queer Voices, and Joan is on the line now from the snow-ridden fields of Iowa.
I'm assuming you have snow.
Yes, well, no, we don't have snow yet. It's just cold.
Okay, if I could just get you to lean a little bit closer into your computer.
Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. And your guest, Joe, is on the line.
Joe, how are you?
Good, good, Joe. Nice to hear you. Happy Halloween.
Yes, happy Halloween. And we have a very Halloween interview to do tonight.
Yes, we do.
Now, tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, we have a book that we've just written. First, it's the organization is a ghost, and we are the largest ghost hunting group in the Pacific Northwest. And we put together this book. It's called Ghostology 101. It's everything you need to know to become a ghost hunter. And we did this primarily for our membership. We have about 120 members, and now the other people are starting to pick this thing up in different states, and they're starting to use it.
Well, great. What made you decide to write a book about this?
Well, I've been investigating the paranormal for about 25 years. Ross Allison is our president. He's been he actually founded this organization about 4 years ago, and we got a lot of people who got together and started talking about ghosts and goblins and things that go bump in the night. And a lot of times, people were like, "Well, I thought I was the only one that saw these things." And we get people together, and they start sharing stories, and then we started doing research on it. And then we put together this book so that we didn't have to retell the tale every time we got together.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about ghost hunting, because that is becoming a little bit more popular. We're kind of looking into it, and it's a little bit different than just going to a haunted house with a Ouija board at midnight, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a lot different. As a matter of fact, we break it down into two different categories. One is an expedition, and the other one is a full-fledged investigation. The expedition, and anybody can do these anywhere. An expedition, you just get one person or two people, or maybe a group, and you go to some place, such as a graveyard, and you look around for paranormal events, maybe some orbs, things, some ectoplasm, things smoking through the area, or maybe pick up some tape recordings with some EVPs and try to do that. And that's not very scientific, but it's a lot of fun. It's a nice walk in the park, and you pick up some strange anomalies that a lot of times you cannot explain. The other one is a full-fledged investigation. For an investigation, we normally go to a place, or we usually get invited either to a business or a private company, and they'll say, "We think there's a ghost here. We'd like you to come and check it out." We'll send an advance party who will go through and map out the area, look for ventilations and ducts and electrical problems, things like that. And then our team will show up, and the team is, they're all trained people. We provide training at no cost to our members. And in order to go on an investigation, you must have the training so you know how to use the equipment. We have the technician, and an observer and a psychic. And the psychics are uncannily accurate with what they find out. And we go into these areas blind, cold, so to speak, so that we don't know anything about the history of the place. And we'll usually pick up, well, we were getting the impression of an old man, maybe he's sick, or a young woman, or something like that. And the electronic devices and all the gear will go off, and we'll start taking some pictures, and we'll see maybe some apparitions. And your listeners can go to our website, which is www.aghost.us. And all of our files are there for people to examine, look at the photographs, listen to the tape recordings. And that's the difference between an investigation and an expedition.
Great. And we're talking to Joe Teagles, who is a co-author with Ross Allison of the book Ghostology 101. And the book's been out now, well, it's just been out since October, so it's been about a month. How have the sales been?
Well, the sales have been pretty good. It's actually, it has been out for about 1 week. And so people are screaming for it. They're going into the bookstores, and they want to get a copy. And some of the bookstores haven't gotten their issues yet. But it's also available on Amazon.com or directly from the publisher. You can go to the publisher at AuthorHouse.com and just look under Ghostology 101, and you can get a copy there.
Okay, and since it's Halloween, Joe, you have to tell us some ghost stories. So give us a couple of examples of some uninspired things that have happened to you during investigations.
Well, some of the fun stuff, and it's kind of funny for a ghost hunter. Last New Year's Eve, our group, instead of watching the fireworks here in Seattle, they went to one of the cemeteries that overlooks the city, and they were doing an expedition where they had their tape recorders and things, and they were looking for strange anomalies. But it wasn't, again, it wasn't an investigation. It was just a walk in the park looking for spooks. And during the event, a man approached them, and he looked like he was a security guard. He had a security outfit on, and he asked what they were doing, and they said, well, we're looking for ghosts. And he said, oh, that's interesting. And he turned and he walked away. Well, at the end of the evening, a couple hours later, they wanted to thank the guy for keeping an eye on him. So they went to the cemetery's main office, and they said, we just want to thank the security guard for, you know, keeping an eye on him. And the cemetery official said, we don't have a security guard here.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. That was pretty neat. So we see some of those things. We get some interesting photographs and some interesting sounds. We're getting ready for our fourth annual Ghost Hunters Getaway up in Port Townsend in Washington, which is one of the most haunted places in this area. And one of our members has been doing some advanced work going through the batteries and the things at Fort Worden, and he's picking up some sounds where he'll take a tape recorder and he'll put it down there, and then he'll come back later and pick up the tape recorder, and there'll be sounds on it or words on it. And the last one that he picked up, of course, it was a dark and stormy night, very much like today, with the rain and the wind battering against it. And the tape recording, it either says, kill them now or tell them now, depending on your frame of mind as you're listening to it. So that's an EVP.
So great, and you guys have a trip coming up to Europe in March, don't you?
Yes, we try to do at least one trip outside of the Pacific Northwest a year. We've gone to Gettysburg. We've gone, matter of fact, Ross Allison's right now is on the East Coast doing a lot of
snow.
Yes, he's shoveling snow over there. And next March, I believe it is, we're going to be doing a European trip. We're going over to England. Some of our members want to go over there and check out our fellow ghost hunters over there. So that's going to be a lot of fun. There's a lot going on right now in this arena. There's a lot of interest coming up. And, of course, with our book being coming out, and we've got Seattle tours that people have asked us to start conducting tours. So we're doing walking tours in the city of Seattle. And we just got back from Victoria up in British Columbia. And while we were there just this past weekend, we encountered four different ghost hunting tours, ghost walks. And they're all over the country. All you have to do is go to the internet and look up ghost walk and a city like Phoenix or Detroit or Chicago or New York, and you can pretty much find one in your neck of the woods. They're fun to go on.
So what got you started on ghostology? Were you just always kind of into ghost stories? Did you have some ghost experiences?
Yes, I was raised on a farm back in Michigan, and it was an old farm. It was built about 1830, and the farm was haunted. There were spirits in there, things that went bump in the night, and then I did my thing in the military, and we went around the world and stuff. And my father passed away in that barn. That's in the farm that I was there. And about 30 days after he passed away, and we buried him, one of our friends called and he said, hey Joe, I just want to let you know, I was in Michigan, I drove by the farm and the place looks great, and your dad was out there getting the mail, and they waved at me and I waved back, and I said that, well, it couldn't have been my dad was, he died a month ago, there's no way it could have been him. And he said, no, it was him. He wears a little red flannel shirt, and he had a little red skull cap on, and so there's something out there. And so that piqued my interest to start doing some more investigation. And then I met Ross over here in Seattle, and he asked me to join the group, and we've been going ever since.
Well, I wanted to ask you, for people who might be interested in the book, Ghostology 1, is it both kind of a new book, new ghost and investigations, as well as kind of a spooky little Halloween for people that just ghost stories?
Well, the book's got a lot of stuff in it. Is it talks about how to become a ghost hunter, how the equipment that we use. It talks about how to assemble a report. It talks about the hidden meanings in cemeteries, and then it also talks about some of the more haunted locations in the state of Washington. We put those in there as well.
But yeah, and I wanted to say the section on the cemetery is really interesting, especially discussing some of the symbols that you find on stones.
In the cemeteries?
Yes.
Well, the cemeteries are, a lot of times, they're historical, and we'll find a lot of historical things in the cemeteries. And so in the book, we put in a section on gravestone rubbings, where you actually take a sheet of paper and rub on it and come up with the image of the tombstone. For example, a very popular one here in Seattle is the cemetery and the tomb of Jimi Hendrix. And so people go up there and they'll make markings on that.
And talk a little bit about some of the symbols on some of the older cemeteries, or some of the older tombstones. Like the skulls, mace symbols and things.
Oh, the symbols in the cemeteries?
Yeah.
Yes, we put those in there. The Masons are a very good group that they should put the Masonic symbol on their tombstones. And we've also found the woodmen of the world here in the Pacific Northwest. A lot of the lumbermen, their tombstones will actually look like trees. We have one person that when he died, his image of him standing up and his dog is right next to him, and his dog is also buried there with him. So that's kind of neat. And so you find some interesting things in the cemeteries.
Great. And tell us again how people can get the book, Ghostology 101.
Ghostology 101 is available at Amazon.com. It's one of the easiest ways to get it. Or they can contact the publisher, which is AuthorHouse.com. Just go to the bookstore and type in Ghostology.1. It's also available at our website, which is www.aghost.us. And, of course, while they're there, they can look at some of the investigative reports that we've done, seen some of the pictures that we've come up with. I would highly recommend that they look at the University Heights in Seattle, Washington. It was with the University Heights of the building that we did, and one of the photographs shows a full apparition in the glass. When we took the picture, there was nobody standing there, but when you look at the photo, you can see that there's somebody that's in the... There's a picture of a ghost there. So that's a good one.
And also online, people that are not from Washington can become online of a ghost, correct?
Absolutely. It's something new that we've come up with. We have Steve Zarkos is our technical director. He's very affluent, he understands the Internet. As a matter of fact, we've started broadcasting our investigations on the Internet. So if you hook onto our website, you can actually watch our team going through an investigation of the houses if the company or the people will allow us to broadcast it. We've been doing that stuff. But we do allow people to join the Ghost. We have an online membership for people that are too far away to come to our meetings. And we host meetings twice a month. And we're getting very busy. We have an investigation going on about once a week, and we have an expedition going on once a week to different cemeteries.
Great. And well, I want to thank you very much, Joe. We've been speaking with Joe Peoples, who is a co-author with Ross Allison of Ghostology 101. Excellent book. I highly recommend it. And Joe, I want to thank you so much, and best of luck with the ghost and with your book.
Well, thank you, and have a nice spooky afternoon, evening, or whatever is left for you.
Great, thank you. You're listening to Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices. And what better time than Halloween to take a look back in time? Let's go back into the show archives, actually back when it was called Lesbian and Gay Voices, back to the year 2000, and the date was October 30th. And Joan was interviewing Gigi about what Halloween is and what it means and what its history is and was.
And Gigi's going to talk to us a little bit about Halloween, because as you know, anybody who lives in Texas or anywhere south, you know, Halloween is surrounded by controversy. For instance, one of the women I work with came up to me today and said her son was just heartbroken because the school had voted not to allow the kids to wear costumes tomorrow. And he was just so disappointed. We're having a celebration at my workplace for the first time in a while. And there's about five of us on the committee, and every one of us on the committee has had at least one person come up to us and express a concern and say that they're rather offended by the fact that we're doing something, quote unquote, for Halloween. So, there's just a lot of myth surrounding it. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, too, points out a broader problem, which JG and I were talking about during the break, which is a very large, intolerant attitude toward pagans and paganism.
And other religions.
Yeah, and basically any non-Christian religion, right. Although I would say that Judaism gets a little less of it.
Yeah.
Probably than, like, paganism, because, you know, there's just this automatic attitude.
Right.
That pagans are Satanists.
That, and we're sacrificing babies and all kinds of myths.
Right. So, why don't you, pardon the pun, straighten some of our audience out about exactly what what Halloween is.
Actually, the roots of Halloween, it wasn't always called Halloween. It's called Samhain, which is the third harvest. The first harvest is Lunasa, which is August 1st. Then Mabon is the second harvest, which is on the autumnal equinox. And then Samhain is the third and final harvest. Basically, Samhain is a time when the veil between the material world and the spirit realm is the thinnest. It's also a time for that the ancients took to kind of give homage to their ancestors who had passed away. And in ancient times, they would actually set a dinner plate at the table for family members who had died in the past in honor of them. Basically, it's the time when all the final crops in the field have been brought in, death is settling into the land, and we're preparing for winter. It's a time to begin the period of introspection and kind of looking deep within, because it's a time when the plants and the land goes to rest for a while.
Now, how is Samhain celebrated?
Basically, it's a ritual that, well, it depends on what pagan tradition you're following. I mean, there's so many different ones out there. You've got the Wiccans, then you've got Celtic, and you've got Egyptian mythology, and just faiths, pagan faiths from all around the world. Different ones have different systems of kind of observing Samhain. Basically, it's just a time to prepare for the upcoming winter. It's a time to prepare oneself for this time of introspection. It's also a celebration time. It's also a time to look at, you know, the sun has died and is preparing for rebirth in the spring. So it's kind of a time when everything's slowing down. It's a time to party and celebrate for bringing in the final harvest. It's a time to be with people and pay respect to one another and to the ancestors that helped bring us to where we are today.
Something that you said, yeah. I know that's practiced in the Spanish or the Hispanic cultures is the Day of the Dead, which is November 1st.
Right.
And that's where that came from, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it all kind of ties in together.
And like I say, you know, you take any one. What has always amazed me about pagan faith is that from any culture around the world, you find in another culture a lot of parallels.
Right.
And there's so much consistency, even in the ancient days when there wasn't much travel. It's just uncanny how the whole world kind of came into agreement on how to celebrate different parts of the year. And paganism is basically an earth-based religion. It's looking at nature, it's following, you know, before the times of clocks, all they had was stars and sun and moon to kind of tell them when the seasons were right for planting, for when it was right to harvest, when it was right to let the fields lay fallow. So there's a lot more kinship to nature than we have in our present-day culture.
To celebrate Samhain, is there any special props or any special things you do?
For me, one of the things, well, I just got back from a huge pagan celebration, celebrating Samhain. And one of the things we did out there was hung up an ancestral web showing the interconnections between the whole family of humanity, how we all are interconnected. And so we created this huge, giant spider web from the top of about a 20-foot pole that came out in the eight different directions, representing the eight positions of the year, the wheel of the year. And those are the times Samhain is one of those stations of the year. So is Mabon, Yule, Imbolc, Astara. They're all different stations of the year. It's divided into eight parts. And Samhain is but one of those eight parts. It's kind of the, like I say, it's the third and final harvest, so it's time to look at what we've accomplished this past year, what we've reaped from our works. And so it's kind of a celebration of that, too.
Now, what are some of the Samhain traditions that have been incorporated into the modern-day Halloween?
One of the traditions is to scare away unfriendly spirits. And the ancients used to make loud noises or clapping of hands and yelling and screaming.
So that's where the tradition of noisy neighborhood kids yelling trick-or-treat came from?
Partly. And also the wearing a mask was supposed to make one either unrecognizable to the dead, unfriendly spirits, and or fool them into thinking that they were spirits and not to be concerned with them as human beings behind masks. So it's kind of an interesting, I mean, so much of that was kind of washed down from the original holiday.
Right.
When it got transformed into Halloween.
But Halloween, Samhain, whatever it was originally, was never evil.
Oh, no.
It was never a time for people to do evil or to celebrate evil or anything like that.
And actually, all paganism predates any form of devil or Satan figurehead. That came with the beginning of the Judeo-Christian era. Before that, devils did not exist. What the Christians termed as the devil was the horned one, which is a mythological figure in paganism.
Is it Pan?
In some traditions it would be Pan, in others it would be just this horn figure that would come about, the horn god, and the goddess being the earth or the moon. The horned one was very tied into being part of nature, being part of the wild animals, the great hunts when they went after antelope and deer. It was never seen as an evil creature, though. So it was later looked on by Christians as being an evil creature,
right,
because that was the only thing they could remotely tie evil to in paganism. So it's kind of an interesting slant.
And that was Joan interviewing Gigi from our archives from the year 2000.
And we'd like to thank all our guests tonight. The election is coming up next Tuesday. You can early vote until Friday. And also the Bayou City Boys Club is going to have the gospel lunch this Sunday. And you can check out bcbc.info. Lily and Phyllis will be at the community center this Friday at 8 p.m. And Lucy Blue Tremblay will be at the MCCR Church on Saturday, November 5th. And we'd like to remind you that next week we're going to be raising money for KPFT. We'll see you then.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org. Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Abdad Dance Troupe, a group of 13 to 16-year-old Palestinian youth from Dehesha refugee camp, will perform at 7 p.m. on Friday, November the 11th at Texas Southern University's Granville M. Sawyer Auditorium. This is part of their 21-city U.S. tour. This event is sponsored by Middle East Children's Alliance, ADC Houston, Free Press Houston, the Arab American Cultural and Community Center, Frenetti Corps Dance Company, Arab Voices, KPFT Houston, and many others. Ibda in Arabic means to create something out of nothing. The organization was built by refugees and for refugees. Funds raised from the U.S. tour will go towards Ibda Cultural Center's programs for children and youth. Free entrance for Katrina victims. For more information, please call 832-474-5556 or 217-766-5907. Also, you can visit arabvoices.net or meccaforpeace.org.
Guess what? You can shorten KPFT's fall pledge drive when you buy back your favorite programming by making your pledge today. You may have heard that 91% of KPFT's operating budget comes from KPFT listeners, just like you. And 75% of the listener support comes in through on-air drives. So you see, on-air fundraising is clearly important. But your gift can help KPFT shift from on-air fundraising to silent fundraising. With your gift in hand, we can work towards ending the on-air drive a few hours or even a few days early. It's up to you. If you've received a letter in the mail, please send in your gift today or make a secure contribution at kpft.org. By pledging early, you will help shorten the on-air drive by 1 hour, 1 day, or even more, so we can get you back to the regular KPFT programming you enjoy. We'll continue to remove days and hours as quickly as you and other KPFT listeners buy them back. That's our pledge to you. So mail your gift or pledge online today at kpft.org. Your gift to the buyback fund will really make a difference in what you hear on KPFT. Thank you for your continued support of KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio, Radio for Peace.
This is Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.